Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. Shalom Aleichem, Assalamu Aleichem, Namaste, Pak Sadnam, Sat Sri Akal, Tashi Dalek, Ho Lila Tanya Wasayake. Hello, may everything be well with you as it is with me. And before we start today's class or teaching, I will do as I do before the start of every class, and that is I will recite the Kaddish for the dead and the mourners of the dead. So please bow your heads, close your eyes, and bring into your memory, into your consciousness, the memory of someone dear to you who has passed away. And in doing so, you will honor their memory by bringing them into the light of your consciousness. Yiskadovi Yishkadash me rabo, bomo di vero kirase, veyamlik melkase, bekayakon uvio mikon, uvkaye dekol, bes Yisrael, baagalo uvizman koriev, veyimru omen. Yehe shme rabo mevorak, leolam uleome omayo, yisbarak veyistabak, veyisbarar veyisramam, veyisnase veyishadar veyisale, veyishalal. Shmeidu kacho meraku, le'elo minko berkaso veshoroso, tushbikoso venekamoso, da'amirom be'olmo ve'imro omen. Yehe shlomo rabo min shamayo, ve'kayim lenu ve'alko Yisrael ve'imro omen. O se shalom bimromov, hu yashe shalom, olenu ve'alko Yisrael ve'imro omen. Thank you very much. Today, we will, after interrupting this course of teaching for two sessions to discuss the concept of religious dogmatism and the Torah police, we will return to what the subject was that we were teaching on, and that is, I was laying the foundation or background, if you will, for what will become a long series in teaching on the subject of Lurianic and post-Lurianic cosmogony. That is the theory, the Kabbalistic theory of how it is that God manifests himself in the world, how the world was created, and how the soul of man has come into existence and how it returns, how it seeks to return to God. And in this background, I was talking about many things that I felt like is really basic foundational material, concepts that one needs to understand if one is just starting out in the study of Kabbalah, without which, if I had just launched into a discussion of Lurianic cosmogony, the person new to the study of Kabbalah would just be lost. So these are the foundational concepts that you need to know about. The final one I'm discussing is the concept of identity. And I've been talking about that a little bit, and today I'm going to wrap that up. We will finish this, and then we will begin our study of Lurianic and post-Lurianic cosmogony starting on Monday. Monday coming up, which will be November the 2nd. Boy, time is moving on. Okay. Now, I'd said before, I'd quoted before, a statement that Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, the Ramchal, great Kabbalist of the 18th century, had made in his great work on Kabbalah, the 138 Openings of Wisdom. a statement that he had made. This is found in 138 Openings of Wisdom, opening 18, part 1. He says, "The entire purpose of the wisdom of Kabbalah is to understand the particular root of each of the different phenomena we find in the world. Anything that can exist without being dependent on something else must have its own root." Okay? We can use this statement, we can take this statement to apply to anything. He says that the purpose of Kabbalah is to seek out, delve into, and by so doing, understand the particular root of each of the different phenomena we find in the world. And by different phenomena, he means everything, actually. He could look at, you could look at, under the category of phenomena, you could look at all the laws which hold this universe together. All the physical laws, okay, that hold this universe together, that goes from the big, that all the physicists and astrophysicists, all the cosmologists are studying about how the universe came into being. You know, so we're talking here about like the Big Bang theory, string theory now, Einstein's general and special theories of relativity, the search for the unified field theory, all of these things, these theories, these physical and mechanical laws are all a part of the physical phenomena that we find in this world. And the Ramchal is saying that the wisdom of Kabbalah, the purpose of the wisdom of Kabbalah, is to understand the particular root of each of these different physical laws. These laws of the physical phenomena that we find in the world. And in essence, we find that there is agreement developing now among the modern physicists. The physicists who are doing research in string theory, and I talked about this a little bit in my last discussion about how there's no such thing really. We used to talk about particle theory, but really now what we're finding out is the particles, so-called particles, aren't particles at all. What we thought were particles are really made up of small bundles of energy, which they call strings. And that these things possess simultaneously the characteristics of matter and energy. The first particle that scientists discovered this for was the photon, quite a long time back. And I don't know exactly when, I'm just not good enough on science, but a long time back, I think in the early 20th century, around the time of Einstein's foundational work on the two theories of relativity, scientists discovered, and for a while there was a debate among the physicists, as to whether photons, which a photon is a quantum of light. I'm going to use the word quantum here as a trick to escape the semantics of the discussion and thereby escape the issue itself, really. But that is what the issue is. That was the center of the controversy. Is the smallest particle of light, is it the smallest unit, I'll use that word, unit of light, which is the photon, is that a particle of matter having mass? Or is light just, is it just a wave that travels through an ether, or not through an ether, but still travels through the universe, looking like a wave on an oscilloscope, or looking like a wave in the ocean? So for some time they debated this. Finally, they came to realize, and now they all agree, that a photon the indivisible, well, now I can't say any more that it's indivisible, but the unit, what we thought was the invisible unit of light, is really both. It is a particle, which does not have mass. It moves, it behaves as a piece of matter moving in a wave motion, moving up and down as energy moves through it. But it also travels. It moves just as something drifts across the ocean. It moves across space and through time. It cannot be conceived until it's... It cannot be perceived by human beings until it's destroyed. A photon that is generated by a star across the universe, say 10 billion light years away, meaning that photon was ejected from the star in the form of light, that's what photon is, 10 billion years ago, and has been traveling all that time toward our Earth, enters the telescope of some astronomer, funnels down through all of the mirrors and tubes, or whatever it is, however that telescope works, and enters in through the cornea of that astronomer's eye, passes through the interior of the eye, the aqueous material in the eye, strikes the retina of the eye, and is obliterated, ceases to exist, or does it? It is transformed, the energy in that packet, that photon, that quantum of light energy, is transformed, it's obliterated in the form of a photon, but it's transformed into a neuroelectric signal that is picked up by the nerve endings in the retina. The retina is actually an extension of the human brain, an extension of the visual cortex of the human brain. Yes. Travels up that neural network, that neural network highway that the retina, that the optic nerve is, and culminates in the visual cortex of the brain, where it's perceived as a signal, as a stimulus. It carries information. That signal carries information, which the visual cortex then sends to all kinds of other parts of the brain, which forms a perception as to the meaning. It assigns meaning to this neuroelectric signal. Information acquires meaning in the human brain. Raw neuroelectrical information is transformed into meaning. And if you want to back it up, the light that's emitted by a star 10 billion years ago is transformed into significance and meaning by the human mind. Now, okay, this is one of the ways that the Ramkal is talking about looking for the root of each of the different phenomena we find in the world. The astronomer looks at that light signal coming in and draws conclusions and makes conclusions, compares it to the facts already stored in the brain and on computers and books, analyzes the differences, and looks for the root, looks for the underlying theories of what's causing these things to happen. In a sense, the astrophysicists, the quantum physicists, the string theorists, who are all looking to simplify the various theories that we have for the universe, for all the phenomena in the universe, they're looking for what Einstein called, and probably someone else before him, but certainly Einstein called the unified field theory, the one theory that will unify all the three other fields, the theory of gravity, the theory of electromagnetism, and the theory the weak atomic field theory. What they're essentially looking for is the root of the roots. And in that sense, what they're looking for, I would submit, is God. Because God is the root, cause, the cause of all causes, the uncaused cause. All right. Now, there are two types of being, and we've talked about this a little bit before, but it bears repeating. There are two types of being, and when I say being, I'm talking about existence. That which creates and that which is created. There are only two conditions, being and non-being, existence and non-existence. And to match that, there are only two numbers. Only two numbers. Now think about this. One, which the Hebrew for is Aleph, or Echad, and zero, which the Hebrew for is Ayin, meaning nothing. Only two numbers. All the other numbers, mathematicians will confirm this, all the other numbers are made up of those two digits. It's the most simple number system in the world. Our decimal system is based on a base 10 system. But you can reduce that down to the binary system. The binary number system is the root number system. It's the root of all mathematics. Okay? And again, we're talking about the purpose of the wisdom of Kabbalah is to understand the particular root of each of the different phenomena we find in the world. One of those roots is mathematics. And one of the major parts of mathematics is number systems. And the root of all number systems is the binary number system, 1 and 0. Aleph or Echad and Ayin in Hebrew. Now, how do I know that there's only these two numbers? Well, we get this because the very first letter of the Torah, one way of knowing this is the very first letter of the Torah. And I'm talking about spiritually knowing this. Gnosis. G-N-O-S-I-S, Da'at in Hebrew, okay? The hidden sefirot, which derives from the combination of wisdom and understanding, Hakma and Binah, is Gnosis, Da'at. And we know from the Torah that the very first letter of the Torah is Beit in the words Bereshit Bara, Elohim, in the beginning, created God. Okay? And Beit has every Hebrew letter is not just a letter of the alphabet, but it's also a number. And Beit, its number is 2. Aleph is 1. Beit is 2. One would think that the Torah would start with Aleph, but it doesn't. It starts with Beit. And that fact is so important that whenever you see in every Torah scroll or biblical commentary when the word Bereshit Bara occur, Beit is written in a gigantic format. It's a supersized letter to always remind the Jews and the readers of the Torah, of the significance of that being, the letter number, the numeral 2 being put in the first position. And there are several reasons for this, one of which is that Beit also means house, and it's the house of Israel, which existed prior to the creation of the world. But it's also the number 2, which means that there's only two things. There's only two conditions, being and non-being, existence and non-being, existence and non-existence. Okay. So we know that 1 is one of the numbers, Aleph, and 0, Ayin, is the other. But we're also told, indeed, 2 or 3 times each day, we as Jews recite the Shema. Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Adonai Echad, Echad, one. The Lord is one. Here, instead of using the letter Aleph in its numerical sense as number one, the Torah uses the word Echad, meaning. And so why does it use this? Well, because Echad specifically has the meaning in the sense of the union or merger of more than one thing into one greater whole. So Echad means one, but it's a one of many things. Now, what does this all mean? Well, it's a reference to Sephira Keter, crown. The first Sephirot, first of the Sephirot to appear, to come into the world, the first manifestation of God. Its name is also Ayin, nothing. Ayin is represented, as I told you just previously, the number zero. But Keter is the first manifestation of God into the world. Ein Sof, that without end, the endless, literally, okay, the unmanifest, transcendental God, which can never be experienced by a human being, because this is God outside creation, and human beings are part of creation. So we can never exist God, as it says in the Old Testament. You cannot look upon the face of God and live. That means that you have to go from being a created being inside created existence to being negated or annihilated if you're going to pass into the realm in which Ein Sof exists. Ein Sof is transcendent. So Ein Sof, that which is without end, and that is at the same time everything but nothing at the same time, okay? Because out of Ein Sof came everything in the world. So that was in Ein Sof to begin with. So Ein Sof is both nothing and everything at the same time. But Ein Sof becomes something, becomes manifest. Ein Sof, which is unmanifest, becomes something which is manifest. The first manifest being, which has the numerical value of one. So Keter's source is nothing. But from nothing comes something. And that something contains every other Sephira that's going to be crystallized out of Keter. All the designs and contents of time in the universe. All life, including all the human lives and their events. All the human lives that will ever be lived and their events. All of these are contained, unmanifest, undifferentiated within Keter. And what did we say Echad means? Literally one. But as I said, in the sense of the one that includes the many. So Keter is the one who includes the many of us, of all the life forms, of all the planets, the stars, all of us in all of our forms that can ever be. Or that ever will be. So Echad is both Ayin, Echad is means one, and is the holy name of God that's revealed to the world when the Sephira Keter came into existence, means literally the one that is the many. Okay, this helps to explain the teaching that we've received that's summarized by philosophers in the Latin phrase ex nihilo creatio, creation from nothing. We've all heard of that or read that. Philosophers say, and from nothing the world was created. Ex nihilo creatio, creation from nothing. Well, what's being talked about here is Keter, its other name is Ayin, which means nothing. And it's from out of Keter that everything in potentia begins to be crystallized or made manifest, meaning from nothing, something is created. Okay, and I mentioned about the holy name of God. Well, before I've talked to you and taught that assigned to every one of the ten sephirot is one of the holy names of God. And what is the name that's assigned to Keter? The name assigned to Keter is Ahaya. Literally, I am means I am. Ahaya is Hebrew for I am, meaning that God now exists inside of time and space as well as outside. Indeed, God made time and space. It never existed either except on the inside of Ein Sof. So, Ein Sof is a transcendent God, and we can view Ein Sof. Actually, I'm going to use a word now to describe Ein Sof, the transcendent God, because I think it's real fitting. I'm going to use the word pressure. Ein Sof, the transcendent God, can be described as pressure. It is the force that cracks the seed of every plant and pushes the shoot, the new shoot, forth, up through the ground, pushing aside rocks, splitting the pavement on the streets, upward toward the light in the sky. That's the transcendent God Ein Sof. Pressure. Pressure to come into manifestation, to come into existence, to come into being. Ein Sof is the source of all energy that feeds into Keter. Now remember, we're looking for the purpose of, according to the Ramchal, the purpose of all Kabbalah is to understand the particular root of each different phenomena we find in the world. And he says that anything that can exist without being dependent on something else must have its own root. Well, and what I'm trying to show you here is that everything that we experience cannot exist on our own. We exist only as a result of a cause, an external cause. And that external cause is Ein Sof. Okay? Ein Sof first manifests Keter, which is a mitotic duplicate of Ein Sof, but it's one that's manifest in time and space. It has all of the potential things in it on a smaller scale that Ein Sof does. And it derives its existence and is dependent upon Ein Sof. So even Keter is a conditional or non-essential being. All right. Now, Keter divides into two opposite sephirot, Chokmah, wisdom, and Binah, understanding. These are the active male principle. That's Chokmah. Chokmah is the active male principle. Indeed, it has a partsuf, a name of Abba, which means father. And Binah, understanding, is the passive female principle in the universe. And that has the partsuf or mystical personality or name named Ima, mother. So father and mother. Combined together, the three sephirot that we've talked about, Keter, Chokmah, and Binah, form Arik Anpin. Okay, they're seen as one whole. Okay, the crown, wisdom, and understanding, or we can say will, thought, and speech. Or we can say nothing, father, and mother. Or king, father, and mother, crown being a symbol for the king. King, father, and mother. The three of these are also known as the Ancient of Days, the Ancient Holy One. And it's this combination of the holy names of God, okay, these three hypostases or expressions of God, manifestations of God, these first three manifestations of God in a triumvirate or a triune or triad, or trinity, if you will, not wanting to, now this has nothing to do with Christianity, okay? They stole it from, the Christians stole it from Hebrew mysticism. But it's this first level of three sephirot that is the God of creation. The three aspects of God named, the three names of God named respectively, Ahayah, Yah, and Yahweh Elohim. That is the God of creation. Yet, as I mentioned earlier, even this is a conditional being. Why? Because it has a root in something else, a root from which it was drawn forth or crystallized out from. It was created from, existed beforehand in potentia in Ein Sof, but exists now in the world. And in fact, the world was made from the Ancient of Days, the Ancient Holy One. It is the God of creation. But yet it came from Ein Sof, the ultimate essential being. If this world, all the life in it, including human beings, our star system, our galaxy, indeed the entire universe, were destroyed. Let's put it this way, we're not destroyed, but we're taken back. We're withdrawn from existence, ceased to exist. Ein Sof would continue to exist, because Ein Sof is without end. Literally, that's what it means, without end, the eternal. Okay, so that's what I mean when I say that the God of creation, which is Yahweh Elohim, and HaKodesh Baruch Hu, the intimate personal God to whom we pray, the God of Israel, they are conditional gods. They are non-essential gods. What I mean is they exist only because Ein Sof continues to will them to exist. How do we know that? Because they're still here. When that day comes, that's no longer true. None of us will exist. Only Ein Sof will be pulled back in. Okay, now, that was, all of this was kind of going to the identity of God, different identities of God, describing God in both terms of his essentialness versus his non-essentialness, or conditional versus non-conditional being. Now, how do we apply this to human beings? We're all human beings. We're all here studying. We're human beings. Well, let's look at what is our identity. First of all, as I mentioned in one of our earlier teachings, I want you to forget as being irrational and illusory your name, your nationality, your job, your education, your interests, your families, your friends, anything you can think of. These are not you. These are not your essence. These are all conditional shells. They're exteriors. They're like a walnut shell, inside of which is the essence of the walnut, the seed. They're like an acorn, which houses inside it the seed from which the oak tree grows. They're pseudo-identities. They're illusions. And you need to get to the point where you can get your mind around that and accept it, because you can't move on until you do. They aren't really you. As the Eastern mystics always say, the Eastern gurus, I am not this body. You're not your body. That's not who you are. That is just a garment in which there is an essence that is you. Carl Gustav Jung, the great, great mystic, avatar, I believe, of the age, of the 20th century, who also happened to be a great psychologist. But that's three or four down the line of identities for him, said, Nowhere are we closer to the sublime secret of all origination than in the recognition of our own selves, whom we always think we know already. Yet we know the immensities of space better than we know our own depths, where even though we do not understand it, we can listen directly to the throb of creation itself. So when we go looking for the secret of all origination, and our astronomers look through those telescopes, and they build ever stronger radio telescopes, they build whole arrays of telescopes, and they look farther and farther out into the universe, looking for the origin of existence. What Carl Jung is saying is that they're missing a great secret here. And that is that the sublime secret of all origination is closer than we think. It lies not in the immensities of space so much as it does in our own depths. Whereas he says, even though we do not understand it, we can listen directly to the throb of creation itself. So Carl Jung is saying that the root of all creation, not just our own human selves, but all creation, lies in our own depths. And it's there that we can listen directly to the throb of all creation itself. So let's do that. Let's start looking into ourselves, into our own depths. If we peel off the garments that I talked about, those false identities, the personas that we assume when we go out into the world, the masks behind which we hide, and we really start searching for who we are, for where we hide, and we start going down into our depths, what are we going to find? Well, you may remember, I think it's good to bring it up again, my use of an analogy of the onion as an analogy. I asked in one of our previous teachings, what is an onion? And I said, you may wish to examine it. I said, so you take the onion, you hold it up, and on the outside is this paper-thin dried skin. So you peel that off, you crack it, you peel it off and throw it in the garbage can or in the compost container. And then underneath this is a moist layer, a skin. You peel that skin off, and underneath that is another layer. You peel it off, and beneath that another. And we keep peeling off the layers of the onion, one after the other, until finally we come to the inside, the very heart of the onion. And what do we find? Well, we're surprised to see that what's there is nothing. The onion is just gone. But there must have been something that gave that onion its form, that made it an onion instead of a walnut, that made it an onion instead of a rabbit. But the heart of the matter, that which is inside all of those layers, is ayin, nothingness. And what did we say ayin is? Ayin, besides the word nothingness, stands for Ein Sof. It stands for Keter, Ein Sof and Keter, which together, ayin is one, ayin is zero, Keter is one. It's Echad. It's the one that contains in potentia all possibilities, all possible forms. Everything comes from nothing, including the onion and including us. So if we peel everything away, if we peel all the layers of our personality away, what are we going to find? We're going to find Ayin. And what is Ayin? Ayin is nothing, but it's also God. It's God manifest in the world. Okay? So we're the same thing as that onion. We came from the same ayin, the same nothingness that the onion came from, that everything comes from, and that's God. Psalm chapter 89, verse 48 says, remember how short, and this is, David is making a plea, is pleading with God. And he says, remember how short my time is. For what nothingness, ayin, you have created all the sons of men. So there we have it. All human beings are created from ayin, from from nothingness. The Zohar, citing Isaiah 40, chapter 40, verse 26, the Zohar says, "Lift up your eyes on high and see who hath created these." That's Isaiah 40, verse 26. And the Zohar says, "This is the limit of inquiry, for wisdom has completed for my end nothing, which is no subject of inquiry, since it is too deeply hidden and recondite to be comprehended." I.N., nothing. Who hath created these? In Isaiah it says, "Lift up your eyes on high and see." Who has created it is I.N., nothing. Has created these? These are what? Everything. All the wonders of the world. All the human beings. Having created from nothing. And what does Zohar say? It says, I.N., nothing, meaning Keter. And beyond Keter, beyond that, is the ultimate I.N., which is I.N. self. I.N. self, okay? I.N. self. Nothing without end. We've got just I.N. in this world, which is nothing. But if we go beyond that, we have nothing without end. Okay? And what does the Zohar tell us of that? Here in Zohar 1, page 30a, says, I.N., nothing, which is from that which has created everything and from which wisdom is completed, which is the subject of no, which is not the subject of inquiry, since it is too deeply hidden and recondite to be comprehended. Well, absolutely. How can the mind, the human mind, comprehend nothing? We can't truly know nothing because we don't exist in nothing. We exist in something. We exist in time and space, all about us and infused in us. And we are a part of time and space. We are a part of something. But deep within inside of us, it's just like that onion. You peel away all of our ego defenses. You peel away all of our personalities, our shells, our garments, our clothes. We take all of it away. And what it comes to in the end, what we're left with, as it says elsewhere, "From dust were you made, and to dust shall you return." But what made us uniquely us isn't what's put back into that ground, into that dust, which consists of, we're told by the physicists, is actually the remnants of explosions of stars eons ago. We're made from stardust. That's what the dust of the earth is. But that's a magnificent thing when you think of it. It's not an ignominious thing. It's a magnificent, splendorous, wonderful, amazing, miraculous thing. But when that goes away, that's not what made us. What made us was the I.N. within us, the nothing within us that is God, the God within us. That goes on, but we can't see it. We can't comprehend it with our limited human mind. And now, something else. I'll finish up by talking about just a little bit here along the same line here, what Jung said. He said this in his essay titled "Psychological Aspects of the Mother Archetype." It can be found in the collected works of Jung, "The Structure and Dynamics of the Psyche," on page 177. He says, this is kind of a long quotation, but it's important. "But why on earth, you may ask, should it be necessary for man to achieve, by hook or by crook, a higher level of consciousness?" So there he's saying, he's admitting, yes, not admitting, he's proclaiming that it's necessary for man to achieve, by hook or by crook, a higher level of consciousness. He says, "This is truly the crucial question, and I do not find the answer easy. Instead of a real answer, I can only make a confession of faith." Colon. And here it is. Here's his confession of faith. "I believe that after thousands and millions of years, someone had to realize that this wonderful world of mountains and oceans, suns and moons, galaxies and nebulae, plants and animals exists. From a low hill in the Athi Plains of East Africa, I once watched the vast herds of wild animals grazing in soundless stillness, as they had done from time immemorial, touched only by the breath of a primeval world. I felt then as if I were the first man, the first creature, to know that all this is. The entire world round me was still in its primeval state. It did not know that it was. And then, in that one moment in which I came to know, the world sprang into being. Without that moment, it would never have been. All nature seeks this goal and finds it fulfilled in man, but only in the most highly developed and most conscious man. Baruch Hashem. What he's saying is that man has a function in this world, and it's a spiritual function. And that function is to realize the existence of the primeval world in our consciousness. That is, to bring the world out of unconsciousness into consciousness. Into whose consciousness? Into our human consciousness. And until we do so, that world does not exist. Well, this brings us back to Keter, to Ayin, to Echad. I said before that Keter has the holy name of God attached to it, and that that holy name of God is Ahaya. Where does this word come from? It comes from the Torah, from the book of Exodus. Remember Moshe's encounter with the burning bush on God's holy mountain in the wilderness? Remember Moshe was tending Jethro, his father-in-law's flock of sheep, and he left them down on the flat area and said, I'm going to go climb that mountain. And he climbed it. And he got up there, and he saw a bush. It was a thorn bush, and it was burning. But unlike any other bush or tree or grassy field or anything else he'd ever seen on fire in his life, the bush was not consumed by the fire. And Moshe said to himself, I must see what this is about. And he approaches the bush, and when he approaches the bush, a voice calls out and says, Moshe, Moshe. And Moshe responds, Hanini, Lord, I am here, your servant is listening. And God says, you may approach, but take off your shoes, your sandals, for you are treading on holy ground. And of course, Moshe did take them off, and he went up to this bush that was on fire, but yet did not consume itself. And God spoke to him from that bush in a voice which he could understand. And he gave him his commission to go down to Pharaoh in the land of Mitzrayim, in Egypt, and to set free the Hebrew people, the Israelites, to lead them out of Egypt, to lead them out of the land of darkness, into the land of enlightenment, into the land of consciousness, to bring them before Mount Sinai, God's holy mountain, upon which Moshe, even now at that time, stood, hearing the voice of God from the bush. He gave them that commission, and then Moshe said, well, surely they will ask me, Lord, what is the name of this God who has spoken to you and told you to do this? And then it was at that time that God said, tell them my name is Ahaya. Ahaya Asher Ahaya. I am. I am that I am. And that goes to the whole essence of existence. It is God who exists. It is Ein Sof become manifest in the form of Ahaya, Keter, the crown, the first Sephira. The Sephira from which all other Sephira, all other manifestations of God were crystallized. It is the Ahaya Keter, the Sephira, from which all the world was created, and from which man was created, from which the two Sephirot, Hakma and Banah, Abba and Ema, mother and father, were crystallized, and then the three of them working in concert created the universe through the 6 days that followed. The next six Sephirot. And then from the last of those, a kingdom was crystallized or emanated. Malkut. The world from which the astral plane, from which this universe and this world and we came into existence. That burning bush, I would submit to you, has been there since before time began. It was called for in the Torah, the blueprint by which God made the world, which existed 2,000 years before creation. That existed in the Torah. It's there. It's in the Torah that's been revealed to us. So it's been there from the beginning, from before the beginning of time. God has been there in that bush waiting for man to experience him, to be the knowing subject as well as the known object. For man to be the knowing subject as well as being the known object of God. You see, that's what Jung is talking about in this last passage that I read to you, in which he talks about standing on the hill, looking across the plains of East Africa, and seeing the vast herd of wild animals grazing in soundless stillness, as they had done from time immemorial. Touched only by breath, the breath of a primeval world. And he says that the entire world round me was still in its primeval state. It did not know that it was. And this is the same for God in the burning bush. He did not know that he was. God did not know that it was. Not just the world, in the case of Jung, but God himself, or itself, in the burning bush, did not know that it was. Until Moses brought it into his consciousness, into the human consciousness. And then, as Jung says, in that one moment in which I came to know, the world sprang into being. Without that moment, it would never have been. That's the same for God in the burning bush. It was only when Moshe said, "Oh, what's this? I'm going to go check this out." And God calls out, "Moshe, Moshe," and Moses responds, that God says, "Ah, I do exist. Something outside of me, something other than me, sees me and experiences." This is the important thing. Experiences me. What is experience? It's an event in consciousness. Experiences me, brings me into its consciousness. I know now that I exist. And he says, "I am." In triumph, he shouts, "I am. I am Asher, happy. Ahaya, that I am. Ahaya, Asher, Ahaya, I am happy that I am." All right, this concludes today's teaching. And I apologize for it running on at some length, but it was important that I cover this point on identity, both from God's point of view and from man's point of view, because there's this interconnection, this interpenetration between the two that can never be torn asunder. Man is a part of God, and God is a part of man. That's just the way it is, and that can never be changed. Praise be to God. Well, until our next meeting, I wish you well, and I ask you to go from strength to strength, and I ask you to remember God at least twice each day. In the meantime, this class will be rebroadcast tonight in its entirety at 10 p.m. Eastern Time. And hope to see you when we start on Lurianic and post-Lurianic cosmogony next Monday at the same time and place. Zagazunt.